Let's go back to Psalms, Psalm 2. Now, we've left off, obviously, in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 4, and I said where we stopped last time that as we deal with the apostles and the time that they spent with the Sanhedrin and how all that worked out, you have, and we're just coming up on this material now as far as the study in Acts, you have a reference to Psalm 2. That's a passage that's really important in the book of Psalms for several reasons. It's also important in the New Testament. So because of my being out of town and trying to get resituated where we are in the book of Acts, I want to look through that psalm today. That's something that we've never done here, and I think that it is a worthwhile study. We're going to read that after a couple of preliminary comments, and then we'll divide it up into about four different sections and see what we can learn from it. As you look at the first couple of points on the sheet, and if you didn't get a copy of the sheet, Stan has those. Item number one, this psalm originally applied to David. That's true for a lot of Old Testament material. They apply to the immediate circumstances. They apply to the person that's being described. But they also had some application to some people later. Sometimes that's referred to as dual fulfillment. And that's what we see in Psalm 2. It certainly had some application to David. Ultimately, though, it looked forward to Jesus. One of the places where we see that is in Acts chapter 4, verses 25 through 27, the text that we want to deal with next time. As you look at this psalm, point number two, 60% of the psalm is either found directly or indirectly in the New Testament, and that's significant. When you have a passage that and it has 12 or 13 verses, it's got 12 verses, you want to make sure that you know what is taught in that psalm, and that's one of the reasons for going back and looking at it. The first psalm is probably the most well-known in the book. Maybe sometimes people start to read through the book, and the first psalm is always read, and they get so far, and then they stop reading through the book of Psalms. But the first psalm is very popular. It's well-known. Anybody remember the gist of it? First psalm, what's it do? Makes a contrast. The contrast is between the good guy and the bad guy, the righteous and the unrighteous. The unrighteous people, they want to run with ruffians and they want to go out and have wicked plans and so forth. But he says the righteous, they're like the fellow who's a tree planted by streams of water, Psalm 1 verse 3, whose leaf does not wither and so forth. And the wicked, they're going to stand in judgment. So you have that in the first psalm. And then as you look at this second psalm, it contrasts the righteous son, ultimately that applies to Jesus, with unrighteous leaders. That, I think, is an important point in any time, but especially in the world in which we live. I give you a fourfold division of the psalm. The rage of the nations. We'll talk about that, and I think that's very relevant for our current world. God holding the nations in contempt. That'll come from verses 4 through 6 after we deal with the first three verses. The nation's rage. The son's decree, verses 7 through 9. And then finally, it ends verses 10 through 12. The nations are advised to obey the Lord's anointed. Let's read the entire psalm, get that before us, and then we'll break it down into those four sections. Why do the nations rage, and the peoples meditate a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against Jehovah and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds asunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens will laugh. The Lord will have them in derision. Then will he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in a sore displeasure. Yet I have set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. I will tell of the decree. Jehovah said unto me, thou art my son. This day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I will give thee the nations for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore, be wise, O ye kings. Be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve Jehovah with fear, and rejoice with trembling. Then finally, verse 12, kiss the son, lest he be angry, and ye perish in the way. For his wrath will soon be kindled. Blessed are all they that take refuge in him. Let's go back to where we started, the rage of the nations. This is going to be verses 1 through 3. When you think about the word rage, the nations, the peoples, the multitudes, the countries rage. What comes to mind when you see that word rage? All right, riot, war. What else?
Heathens,
yes. You think about that as well. People who have cast off any fear, any concern, any love for God. What else? The nations rage.
They want what they want.
All right, they want what they want. And if you try to tell them to go some other direction, what kind of reaction are you going to get? It's going to be absolutely rebellion, isn't it? And you can see that as you start thinking about the nations. Here's God's will, and there are some people, especially when you start looking at national leaders, they reject that out of hand, and they simply refuse to have God as their God. Now, as you look at verse 2, we'll look at that again as far as reading it. The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against Jehovah and against his anointed, and then they say some things. According to that passage, who's often the cause of the rage? The people in general or the leaders? It's the leaders. And that nation is probably going, I mean, you can have some movements and protests, things like that, but generally it's going to be the leaders. I can remember many years ago being in Ukraine, one of the most unusual experiences I think I had on foreign soil. There was this fellow by the name of Gennady. I've lost touch with him over the years. But he was in the military at the same time I was. And he talked about some of the briefings that he had. I was receiving some of those same briefings on this side of the world. And the leaders were telling him, the Americans, they want to do you in. They want to destroy you. And we need to make sure that our military is on the up and up. And we're always mindful of the fact that those evil Americans want to attack us and kill your family and so forth. Well, I was getting fed the same information over here. Now, looking at that fellow who was probably 18 or 19 years old at the time, do you think he wanted to come over and kill Americans? No. You think the people on our side of the fence who are 18, 19, 20 years old, they wanted to go over and kill the Russians? No. But who was keeping the tensions ratcheted up? The people at the top. So oftentimes, if you could remove those people, in our case, it's not just the leaders. Who else is it sometimes? Who feeds unrest? That's it. If they wouldn't be out there with their TV cameras stirring that stuff up, and you've got maybe a few protesters out there, and the whole nation thinks, well, they're against this, and half the country is opposed to this, that, and the other thing. But you do have some people. We've seen that in the Wednesday night classes, haven't we, with Jesus? It's not the average guy out there who's calling for the Lord. You've got the religious leaders. They're out there stirring the people. So this rage of the nations, you see it in a lot of different ways. So verse 2 makes that very, very clear. The cause of the rage, sometimes the people, more often than not, though, the leaders. Anything else you want to add or ask before we pick up with that next point? All right, picking up with subpoint 3, what does set themselves in verse 2 imply? They set themselves against God, against his anointed.
They'll all agree together and won't change.
Okay, I think you have to include that. They have come together, there's a consensus. There's a mindset there for the group. Anything else? I've set themselves.
Determined.
All right, determined. We sometimes have a person say, I brace myself for this, right? What do you brace yourself for? Figuratively and literally. Okay, we've got about 3 answers there. Let's separate them. We'll start with figuratively. Somebody says, I brace myself for that. What do they mean, figuratively speaking? All right, yeah. If you're looking at that literally, they see that there's a crash up ahead and they maybe try to either relax their body or they try to tighten things up. They try to prepare for the impact. What else? What if you've got a big bill coming up? You know that the furnace is not going to make it one more year. You know that you have some medical bills. You know that you need maybe an expensive medical device. Don't you brace yourself for the bill? You prepare. So when you think about setting yourself for something, you have the idea there is God, there's his will, we're going to resist him, and what's our resistance going to be like? We're going to... Well, okay, at least that's a desire. You can't do it, obviously, but that's a desire. We're going to prepare to fight against God. We're going to steel ourselves, we're going to brace ourselves, we're going to make sure that we try to put everything in place. Absolutely.
So for this is like, oh, we're in the end time, and blah, blah, blah. This has gone on years before. So we have to learn from this and not give up hope.
That's right. Nations, as you look at time, they have been, as you look throughout time, they have been doing this for a long, long time. You find very few nations that have actually looked to God and said, we want to follow you, we want to do your will. There's that active resistance. Because ultimately, who's at the head of the opposition? Yeah. Now, you can take that back to the people and the leaders, but if you take that one more step back, it's ultimately going to be the devil. And he's there as far as trying to keep the nations agitated and in a state of anger against God. Subpoint four, are there still ways people try to take counsel against God? Not only set themselves, but take counsel. Let's maybe break that down a little bit. Somebody says, let's take counsel. What do you think that means?
They get together and talk about it, and they try to figure a way of doing it differently. We see that in the world today. I'm reminded of the story back when Joshua went into Canaan, and the kings gathered against them and tried to fight that. We have that same thing today. World leaders coming together, making some kind of contract or... We see it today, too.
Yeah. Council, contract, some big powwow. There is a conference where they get together and say, take counsel. Isn't that what the Sanhedrin was doing? Remember we talked about from Acts chapter 4? They were trying to throw together ideas. They were looking for something to try to deal with the apostles, and nothing was working. People today, now they may not sit down and say specifically, let's take counsel against God. But as far as God's precepts and general principles, his moral law out there in the world, people are not too enthused about it. How do they take counsel against God?
Yesterday, I didn't get to catch it on the news, but I guess it was a big, wasn't there a big protest or what you want to call it with Planned Parenthood, which would be in contrast to when they had the March for Life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's get our protesters together. Let's organize an organization where we can attack this moral teaching or this particular belief. So they do that sometimes through the courts, sometimes through marches. Anything else? How people take counsel against God? All right. Let's go ahead and work on the schools. We'll remove prayer. We'll remove the Bible. We'll take away these things from society. So people have been taking counsel against God for a long, long time. Verse 2. This goes back to what Ray was saying just a moment ago. It almost sounds like a large meeting of the minds. Let's come together. We'll have this summit. We'll have this conference. We'll have this get-together. And we will see how we can promote our wicked ways. It's not new. It's been done for a long, long time. Verse 5. Give examples of how men want to break the bounds God set for mankind. Let's look at that again, because as you look at it initially, you might not quite get the point. It says, let us break their bonds asunder. Now, that's not human bonds. That would be God's will. Let's break God's bonds. Let's cast away the cords from us. It's almost like people, they look at God's will, God's ways, and they see that as slavery. They see that as inhibiting their freedom. And they say, let's figure out a way to throw off God's shackles. Let's get rid of him. Let's bury God. Society do that? How do they do it? You think you have any non-Christian preachers? You think atheists are preachers? They are. They're out there. They're shouting a message from the housetops. They've got their own Bible. It may not be Mark Bible, but they've got their own message. And they're out there promoting it in every possible way. And it's, let's get rid of God. Take him out of schools. Take him out of society. Christians are, and I think we talked about this within the last month, Christians are really that last roadblock. If you want a secular society, you have to bulldoze God's people, any vestige, any hint of Christianity. And once you take down that wall, once you remove that barrier, then you can have the path wide open for a secular society. Bonnie?
It's like a conspiracy, if you think, the way I see it. It's like when you look way back, was it in the 50s or the 60s with Madeline Murray O'Hare, when all that happened, but... You know, they're slow, very incremental steps to get to the goal that they want.
Yeah.
It may take 50 years or 100 years, but they've got a pattern. To me, it's like a conspiracy. They've got this pattern.
Yeah, it is. And
marching towards it.
It is, and this is the ultimate goal. Let's throw off the shackles of God. Let's move past that. We're in the enlightened age right now. And they're willing to do that incrementally, if that's what is required, whether it's the courts or... training new minds, sowing the seeds of evolution. They do that in a lot of different ways, but they're persistent. They're very, very persistent. Therese?
Well, I came in late, so I don't know if this has been said, but higher education, even at Christian schools like Free Hardeman, is starting to cast doubt by studying what other cultures taught about the ark and the flood. first cow to stink out, and I saw that in Memphis with some of Liz's friends. They had a youth minister who did not believe that all the animals fed in New York. And I'm thinking, how can you believe anything if you don't believe the basics? So.
Yeah, there have been a lot of Christian schools that have undone teaching that mom and dad and local congregations did. They taught their kids the truth. The children go off to school, whether it's at the undergraduate level or the graduate level, kids get exposed to some liberal thinking professors, and they're overcome by the academic setting that they're in, and they think, well, hey, mom and dad didn't know this, that poor preacher back home, he surely wasn't enlightened on this, and now we're going to throw off those shackles. So yes, it comes sometimes even from a religious school, and that's very sad. Bonnie, I'll come back to you in just a second. Glenda, I think, or Betty had a hand next. Betty, we'll start with you. Oh, Glenda? Okay. Yeah, and there are some people who would put that on the same level as Scripture or even higher. It's, well, you've got your book, we've got another book that works just as well. Maybe it's even better. And, you know, if what we want is not in the book, we'll just write our own poem or write our own...
It's got to be a deception.
Yeah.
Especially to, like, if his mother would have been there, even though she was a staunch Catholic, she would never have approved of that.
Yeah, but just think about that. Casting off the shackles of God, that's how they see it. And that's something that they really want to do. People felt like they were making some progress as far as getting rid of the quote-unquote shackles, and now you're going to put us back in chains, so to speak. So yes, that is the feeling that some do have. Chris?
I don't know that Freed was teaching false doctrine, but this young man did go to that Bible program. That was me.
Yeah. So it's there in our schools. So it is a problem. All right, now, let's take that. You've got that foundation as far as how the nations want to think and live and reason. The rage of the nations. So with that in mind, let's go back and look at verses 4 through 6 now. We'll start with verse 4, emphasize that. He, who is that?
God.
God that sits in the heavens will do what? Laugh, and the Lord will have them in derision. Do you see the contrast? All the nations that we talked about, let's throw off the shackles, let's get rid of God, we're going to have our protest, and we're going to form this organization, and we're going to get God out of the schools, and we're going to burn the Bibles, and we're going to get the movement where God is dead. All that stuff is going on, and the world stands back and cheers and says, look at us, we've had such great success. God says, I do what? I sit. Now think about that for a minute. Is that significant? God says, I sit. You've got this guy, he comes up and says, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to beat you to a pulp. I'm going to bust all your bones and put you in the hospital. Are you just going to sit there in a chair?
Well, is this implying that God is sitting on his throne in heaven looking down at all this laughing?
It is, but let's back up just a little bit. Somebody says, I'm going to just knock the snot out of you. And he's got the big tire iron coming your way. Got a knife. Are you just going to sit in the chair? Not usually. Why? Because the guy is he's a threat to you, isn't he? I mean, he's got the knife, or he's got the gun, or he's got the tire iron. You're going to get up, and maybe you're going to fight, maybe you're going to flee, but you're going to have to act. Hear the nations say, God, we hate you, we despise you, we're going to oppose you. Is God running off the throne?
No.
What's he doing?
Sitting there.
Sitting there. Now, just before we get to the laughing part, sitting there tells us what about God?
He's in control.
He's not worried about the nations. Every person on the planet, every king could come together with all the weaponry that is available, and God says, look, you're going to fight against me. I'm just going to sit here. You're no threat. And God says, not only am I going to sit here, what's the next part of that? God says, I'm going to laugh. Why would he do that?
Because you think you're so powerful.
Yeah.
You know what power is.
It's like the infant who says, I'm going to take on the battalion of tanks, really. What are you going to do as a six-month-old compared to that line of tanks over there? There's nothing that you can do. They're just going to squash you like an ant. And that's what God says to the nations. I have no fear of you. In fact, if anything, I'm going to have you in a state of
turmoil,
derision. So if that's the road that you guys want to go, remember in the book of Acts, it's hard to fight against the goats, pricks. Remember that verse? It's just not going to work. Somebody had a hand, a thought?
I find that comforting.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's like, whatever.
Yeah, it is. You know, nations can go out there, people can rail, and they can say all the things that they want. But at the end of the day, you know, you guys are nothing. Anybody else want to make a quick point about that? All right, let's go back to our sheet and see what else we have. Verse 4 says, let's fill in the blanks. God sits in the heavens and laughs. And then that sub-point, God has never been threatened by any men and no force of man. And as Glenda rightly said, we should have great comfort in that. God, however, does he pay attention to man? Let's see verse 5. Then will he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. So, as all of this stuff is unfolding throughout time, in our time and certainly in previous generations, does God pay attention to what men are doing?
Yes.
Absolutely. Not threatened by it, but he certainly is taking note. And as he looks at that, he can easily punish people. And sometimes, as you look at scriptures, that's exactly what he has done. God is also, as we look at the point, actively involved in carrying out his will on earth. Going back to verse 6 for just a second, he says, not I will set, but what? I have set. Now that's interesting. If this ultimately applies to Jesus, God says, I have set my king. Even before you get to the first century, God looked at things and said, guys, guess what, when it comes to the Lord? Is he going to succeed or is he going to fail?
Success.
You know, he can be mistreated. He can be rejected by the Jewish people. He can be mocked. He can be crucified. But God said, I have set the Lord as my anointed. And he is going to reign. If he's been able to do that through all the things that we know happen, then certainly when we think about the end of time, it's going to be successful as well. He says, I've set him upon my holy hill of Zion. And then you get into verses 7 through 9 where you talk about the decree. All right, how did the nations rage against Jesus? Or did they rage against the Lord? Sure. Yeah, when you look at the Jews, there were times where they tried to shut down his teaching. You have the brightest minds in Israel coming to Jesus, trying to trap him at different times. None of that worked. What else, as far as trying to shut down the Lord, the anointed? Well, okay, let's see if we can back up and add a little bit more. But ultimately, that's what happened. What else? Trying to shut down the Lord.
The devil tempted him.
All right, very early on, we certainly would want to include that. Satan shows up. That doesn't go so well. What else? All right, multiple attempts, even when Jesus is in his hometown, I think that's in Luke chapter 4, they didn't succeed there. What about Judas? Let's work on him. Let's work on him through Peter. You have event after event, and yet God says, I've set him, he's going to succeed, and that's exactly right. Even with the death that Jeff mentioned, you get to the Lord being buried, death wasn't able to hold him, he comes back, and he is successful in every way. Point 7, this is related to not so much Psalm 2, but when I was away, I had a chance to hear some lectures, and the most interesting lecture I heard, and it was kind of a 3 or 4 part series, was from a man who grew up in Baghdad. His time in Baghdad involved the period when Saddam Hussein was in power. that man has now become a Christian and is trying to do a lot as far as convert other Muslims that live in the United States. There have been few lectures over the past 20 years which I have heard and said, really, wow, at the end of it, but I did each time I heard that fella present his information. Some fascinating things, some things I didn't know, just a couple of oddities, and then I'll connect it to what we're looking at. I didn't realize that during his lifetime, or even during Saddam's reign, that Saddam was infatuated with Nebuchadnezzar. But, you know, Nebuchadnezzar in that same area, so this fellow, as he was trying to sort things out, he eventually got a Bible. And if you're growing up in that same area where Nebuchadnezzar was, you would obviously be familiar with some of the history, and when you look at the book of Daniel, some references there. So he doesn't really know anything about Christianity, doesn't know anything about God. In his mind, Christianity is fake, it's all a lie, and so forth. So he starts reading books like Daniel and reads about Nebuchadnezzar and reads about some other historical facts. And the quote from him that I remember in that part of the class was, wow, the guy who wrote this book really knew his stuff. Well, that, of course, was God. But as he thought about the book of Daniel, it was like, yeah, okay, you know, that's 50 miles that way, and I've seen that. He said, and I did a little looking online, he said that as he was growing up, you would have pictures of Saddam Hussein here and King Nebuchadnezzar right here. And if you go online, you can actually find some coins that Saddam minted. And either together on the same side of the coin or on both sides, kind of depends on which coin you're looking at, but Saddam will be on one side of the coin, Nebuchadnezzar will be on the other side of the coin. So Saddam Hussein was really fascinated by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, as you look at that part of the world, his understanding of Iraq and Islam was basically this, that Saddam wanted a purely secular society. And Saddam started to divest the nation of everything that was religious. Doesn't that remind us of Psalm 2? What did we hear earlier? The nations rage against God. Let's eliminate this. Well, if you're a dictator, you've got a pretty good shot at trying to pull that off. And there have been some people who have been dictators that have tried to eradicate a religion from the country that they ruled over. And he said, and he grew up during this time, he said, as Saddam did that, as he began to purge religion from the land, he began to realize that all of a sudden that wasn't going to work out too well. Remember what we've picked up from a Revelation class. How many beasts did John talk about? Two. There's the evil beast of civil government, and the evil beast of false religion. Those two things are the most powerful forces in the world. Saddam realized that he could not have a successful country without religion. So he looks at the situation and says, we can't eliminate religion and succeed. So we're going to have religion. Well, if you've got a lot of people who are Muslim, guess what? It only makes sense to start promoting the Muslim religion. So Saddam began to bring the Quran into school. The Quran was taught. He began to build all kinds of mosques, and it became a predominantly Muslim country. Now, this fella develops an interest in the Bible, is looking for a Bible, comes to the point where he believes he needs to be baptized. He said, it took me 12 years to get baptized. 12 years. He went to, from what he described, just about every church in Baghdad and some other areas, and nobody would baptize him.
He self-taught, or did someone?
I would say the most of it, at least in the early period, came from self-teaching. And then finally he was able to apply for the refugee status, and he was finally able to get out of Iraq and figure some things out. He ended up with an Amish family for a little while and was over in Pennsylvania. And if you talk about God's providence, it sounds like that's what happened in this young man's life. But the forces of Iraq were so powerful that they prevented that young man from being baptized for 12 years, even though he wanted to be. He said during that presentation, he said, 6 years, after the first 6 years, that was during the Iraq War, he was stopped. He and the guy that he was with, there were some Americans that stopped him, had him put the arms up against the wall. He thought he was going to be shot. And said, Lord, you know I want to be baptized. I just haven't been able to get it done. And he said, you know, have mercy on me if they kill me. He thought he was going to be executed. And his hands got tired, and he spoke in English. And the guy said, you know English? Yes, sir. Well, you can put your hands down. And they freed him because he was able to speak some English. He taught himself English. So really a fascinating thing. But I tell you all that to make the point that when you look at people who are hostile to God, It can be, just like the Sanhedrin that we're looking at in Acts chapter 4. There is that rage there, and we're going to do our best to stamp out the Christianity, the faith. We may bring in a false religion like Islam or something else, and it really becomes very, very difficult for people. And one of the other points he made, he said, you guys don't know how blessed you are. We can look at America and see some of the stuff that's been done, and yes, we have our problems, but he said, had you grown up in a place where, you know, I was for many years, the decision to become a Christian, it cut him off from his parents. You know, he's paid a heavy price, but, you know, people will do that. And I think that may also help account for God's contempt on the nations. If you're going to, remember, Jesus talked about, I don't remember the reference right off, but he talked about making people a twofold child of hell. He said, you're not going in and you try to make other people unable to go in as well. He didn't look at that very kindly. And there are some people in life who do that same kind of thing. They don't want to go, and they try to hinder or stop others from going to heaven as well. And that's a very serious thing. Anybody want to add or ask something based on where we are? Okay.
For the scripture, you know, God tells you that if you hinder a person, it's worse for you than if you
yes.
had not.
Yeah. Bad enough that you're lost, but if you're going to drag some other people down into the ditch with you, whether that's a little child or somebody who's seeking, yes, you're going to pay a heavy price for that. But there are some people who do that, and some of those people are sometimes leaders of nations. Okay, two more sections. The decree of the Son, and this is what we find in verses 7 through 9. God says he has a son. That's very clear from Psalm 2. We also find that information in the New Testament. If you look at some religions, though, in the world, they do not believe that. The Islamic faith, going back to them for just a minute, is one religion, one faith that does not believe that God has a son. In fact, the Quran is very, very clear about that. You deserve to be punished, you know, basically death, if you believe that God has a son. But that's exactly what the Bible describes. The word begotten, we don't hear that word being used too often. My best understanding of begotten is that word means unique, distinct, the only one of its kind. For example, you know, did Abraham have one son or more than one son? More. But was there a special son? Was there a unique son?
Yes.
Which one was that?
Isaac.
Isaac was the begotten son. He was unique. He was distinctive. There was something special about him and no other child. And that's Jesus. When you look at that word, you relate it to Christ, you can, I think, have a greater appreciation for Jesus coming into the world. Now, if you had more than one child and you had to sacrifice one child, that would be traumatic. And you wouldn't look at that and say, well, okay, I lost one, but I've got another one. That's great consolation to me. It would still be upsetting. But imagine that you have only one son. And that one is the one that you're giving for someone else. And that son is not only the only son, the only child, but special for a number of reasons. And that's what God was willing to do with us. Now, this fact is going to come up a little bit later. We'll not look at this today, but in Acts chapter 13, verse 33, Paul also, in that passage, refers back to what we have here in Psalm 2. So this is something, as far as this psalm, that we see, as I said earlier, throughout the New Testament. All right, ask me, as you look, is that in verse 7 or 8? Let's see. It's 8, thank you. Ask of me, and I will give thee the nations for thine inheritance. When you look at the Bible, and I have here an Old Testament reference, I have a New Testament reference as well, you have a practice among ancient kings. They would say, ask something of me, and I'll give it to you. Anybody remember a New Testament reference that reflects that fact? Ask me what you will, and I'll give it to you. All right. You're thinking of Herod.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has the dance there. He and his lords are together. There's the dance, and he promises the young lady, what do you want? I'll give you something up to how much of my kingdom?
Half
my kingdom. So you have that practice reflected there. You could also go back into the book of Esther, chapter 5, verse 6, to see it. Ask of me, and I'm going to give you what? For your inheritance. I'm going to give you the
nations.
Well, doesn't that sound a little bit like what we find in the New Testament? Remember over there in Matthew, chapter 28, verse 18? Jesus said, and all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. That was really foreshadowed by Psalm 2. And Jesus does have that authority, that power. You have there, as far as point 7 and the last subpoint, verse 4, Jesus' power is highlighted in verse 9. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Keeping that in the context, remember how we started? The nations, what do we find them often doing when it comes to God? They rage. They rebel. They say, we're going to withstand God. We don't care about your power. We don't like your laws. You are trying to shackle us. And God says, if you want to live in that way, you want to come fight against me, what will I do to you? I'll just smash you in pieces. I don't want to do that. I sent my son into the world. I want to help you. But if you want to make war with me, we'll go toe-to-toe. Now, I have here three passages from Revelation that I'd like to have read. Revelation 2, Revelation 12, Revelation chapter 19. From Revelation 2, verses 26 and 27. Who'd like to head over there and take responsibility for that? Jeff, thank you. And then we'll look at Revelation 12, verse 5. Gary, you want to take that one? Thank you. And then Revelation chapter 19, verse 15. 19, 15. All right, that'll be Tina. Thank you. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 2, looking at verses 26 and 27.
And he who overcomes and keeps my works until the end, to him I will give power over the nations. He shall rule them with a rod of iron. They shall be dashed to pieces like a pot.
All right, now, that's an interesting idea expressed there, because we're not dealing about with Jesus per se, but we're dealing with the saved. Christ has that power, Matthew 28, Psalm 2. But the Lord says, if you want to be one of my people, will you be able to share in that part of my overcoming? Yes. So they do have some authority over us, certainly in this life, and there are some decisions that they can make. There are some things that we may not like when it comes to their decisions. But the Lord says, you're on the winning side. They will be in power for a while. And you think about that, and sometimes you find that nations don't do so well. What was Saddam's end? Where'd they find him?
Like an animal
in a hole. So here's the fella. He compares himself to King Nebuchadnezzar. Basically, I'm a god. I'm the one who's going to run the country. And yet, pulled out of that spider hole. And then ultimately, what's his end? Death by hanging. Not a very attractive way to go. So, he did have his free will. He used that for a period of time. God brought him down. And that's going to ultimately happen to everybody else, whether they're a leader, whether you have several leaders, and God says, look, Revelation 2, you can be on the winning team. And that's a great message for us. Revelation 12, verse 5.
And she brought forth a man-child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne.
Okay, in this section of Revelation 12, John just offers kind of a quick summary of the Christian faith. And he makes that point. He says, Jesus, the ruler of the nation with the rod of iron, which is exactly what we have back in Psalm 2. Then in 19:15, Tina, I think that's yours.
Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with the rod of iron. He himself treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God.
Okay, a lot of people, I think, look at God and sort of have the old man in a rocking chair mentality. That's not what the Bible says. Christ is the ruler of the nations. And he allows them at least some free will, gives them free hand to do some things, not all of which is good or things that we might enjoy in this life. But still, he is overall and has the power to crush them. Anything that you want to add or ask before we sum it up with verses 10 to 12? Glenda? Well, let's take that and develop it for a minute. What if Jesus had accepted the Lord's offer? Or what if Jesus had accepted Satan's offer? The devil says, I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world, and let's say that the devil could follow through. What would have happened to the Lord?
He would have died.
All right. He would have died. He wouldn't have been the Savior. And what would have happened as far as the earthly kingdoms and rule? At least from our perspective, it would seem like when he dies, that's it. He lays that down. But he wanted to be the eternal King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and he turned that down for the greater choice.
And he also called him a liar.
Yes, he did. All right, advice for national leaders, verses 10 through 12 in Psalm 2. Let's take a look at those three verses again and close it out. Now, therefore, see the conclusion? Therefore, be wise, O ye kings. Be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve Jehovah with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and ye perish in the way. for his wrath will soon be kindled. Blessed are all they that take refuge in him. God says to the leaders, be wise, be smart. Take instruction from me. Don't trust your own insights. Don't trust your own power. Don't trust the army. Don't trust the alliances that you can make with other nations. Serve God, honor God, respect God, verse 11. The Son, verse 12, is the only key to success. Well, didn't Jesus kind of leave us with that same impression in John chapter 14? I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes unto the Father but by me. He is the one that people need to turn to. And if you reject the Son, things are not going to go well. Two more passages from Revelation. Revelation chapter 6, 16 and 17, and Revelation chapter 14, verses 9 through 11. Who will take Revelation 6 for us? That'll be Betty. 6, 16 and 17, Revelation 14, 9 to 11. Who wants that one? All right, Glenda. All right, Betty, if you're ready. Revelation chapter 6, 16 and 17. All right, Jesus has that rod of iron that he's able to use when it comes to ruling the nation, and here you see that rod of iron being exercised. The wrath of the Lamb. We've not followed God. Who can save us from that wrath? The implication is nobody. They're looking for a place to hide. There is no place to go. And then Revelation 14, verses 9 through 11. Choose the wrong way, tormented forever and ever, and then it talks about the wrath of God, and it says it's, if you mix something, for example, you have some lemonade, and you start pouring a lot of water in it, what happens to the lemonade? You water it down. But what does John say in that passage? The wrath of God is undiluted. It's full strength. It's not going to be watered down. And he has the power to do that, and the Bible affirms that he will do that.